And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Acclaimed evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins is scheduled to speak in Des Moines at Hoyt Sherman Place this Saturday afternoon. The ticketed event is being put on by Secularity USA, a group that says its primary goal is raising public awareness of the dangers of religious bias in government and promoting traditional separation of church and state. For the rest of this hour, we'll listen back to a conversation I had with Richard Dawkins from November of 2009. At that time, we were marking the 150th anniversary of the publication of Charles Darwin's seminal work on evolution, On the Origins of Species. Richard Dawkins is widely considered Darwin's most passionate, accomplished interpreter, and his new book at that time, when we spoke in 2009, was titled The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution. So let's listen back to my conversation with Richard Dawkins from 2009. I began by asking what he thought were the biggest misconceptions people had about evolution.
An awful lot of people think that what we are saying is that somehow there's a great sort of cosmic dice thrown, and this leads to things springing into action by sheer random luck. Now, of course, if it were like that, you couldn't possibly get something as beautiful as, well, any animal or plant you care to mention, or something as elegantly apparently designed as something like an eye. Something like an eye, which looks like a camera, behaves like a camera, has detailed features which are just like those of a camera, focusing an image on a retina with a variable stopping mechanism to cut down the light to exactly the right amount, variable focus. This clearly looks totally as though it had been designed. And many people think that means that it has been designed. Many people think that the only alternative to design is random chance. And that's the big mistake. That's the answer to your question. The big mistake is to think that the only alternative to design is random luck, random chance, as though you took the bits of an animal, took the atoms, and shuffled them around at random. And hey presto, out drops, let's say an eye. Mm-hmm. And of course, it doesn't happen like that. It happens by natural selection, which is a gradual process, a cumulative process, which starts from simplicity and then works up by slow, gradual degrees.
Isn't also a problem that you face in getting this across just the amount of time involved? We find it hard to conceive of a million years.
That's exactly right. We find it very hard to conceive of a million years, and to get to grips with evolution, you've got to go for tens of millions of years, hundreds of millions of years. We can't even deal with 1 million years, and that's one of the major problems. People will say things like, oh, show me a monkey that gives birth to a human or something like that, as though it was supposed to happen in that short a time span, in the time span of a human lifetime. It's as though we were a flea on the hour hand of a clock. You can't see the hour hand of the watch moving, but if you wait long enough, you find that it has moved.
You mentioned the eye, the wonder of the eye developing through evolution just a moment ago, but also in your book you point to certain anatomical developments that are absurd and therefore you say also prove evolution. The bungled eye is an example you give. What is the bungled eye?
Well, yes, there's a fascinating contradiction between how on the one hand the eye looks like a beautifully designed camera, but on the other hand there are features of it which are just, as you say, bungled. The retina, which you could think of as a bit like the bank of light-sensitive cells at the back of a digital camera. You know, the back of a digital camera has a matrix of light-sensitive units with wires leading backwards to a memory chip, which is then fed into a computer. Well, in the eye, it's back to front, so that the light-sensitive cells of the retinal cells are pointing backwards. They're pointing away from where the light comes from. And the wires that connect them to the brain come out in the front, and they carpet the retina. So the retina is completely covered with nerves which are leading from these backwards-pointing light-sensitive cells, and then they have to get to the brain somehow, so they have to dive through a hole in the retina, which is called the blind spot. It is blind if light falls on that spot where the nerve cells dive through. You don't see it.
Mm-hmm. And so why didn't the eye develop through natural selection in a way that doesn't create a blind spot?
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. It's a historical accident. Once something starts to evolve in a particular direction, in the early stages it probably didn't matter very much. But once it starts and uses a system of embryonic development, the eye develops in a certain way from as an outgrowth of the brain. Once it starts developing in that way, although natural selection might ideally like to do what a human engineer would do, which is go back to the drawing board, throw away the existing design and start afresh, which is the privilege of any human engineer. You can do that.
Mm-hmm.
With evolution, you can't do that because you're committed. The species, the lineage, is committed to a certain way of developing. And although it might ultimately be better to go back to the drawing board, it can't be done because the intermediates would all be they'd be blind.
You write in your book that we can actually look at our dog to better understand evolution and dog breeding. Explain why that is.
This was a point that Darwin himself made rather well. If you take the theory of natural selection, which, as you know, is differential survival, the survival of the fittest in the struggle for life, if you wanted to do an experimental test of the power of selection to guide evolution, what would you do? You would take animals and you'd select them yourself. You would deliberately choose which ones to breed from. And that's exactly what our ancestors did with dogs and what we do with dogs. So when you look at things like Whippets and Pekingeses and Poodles and Great Danes, what you're seeing is modified wolves. Our ancestors took wolves and the descendants of wolves and modified them in directions to become small, fluffy, long sausage dogs like Dachshunds, sheepdogs. They took wolves and modified them by artificial selection. Now, that shows the power of selection. That shows that selection really works to guide evolution remarkably quickly. That's artificial selection, human selection. And if that works, there's no reason why natural selection shouldn't work too. That was Darwin's great insight.
Let's talk about something else that, at least on its face, doesn't seem to fit into the theory of evolution. How does homosexuality fit into the theory of evolution? Why? What good does it do for a species to have a certain number not geared toward procreation?
It's only a problem if there's a genetic component to being gay, and actually there is, as we know from twin studies. You know, twin studies is where you compare identical twins, monozygotic twins, with dizygotic twins. Monozygotic twins have all their genes in common, and dizygotic twins don't. And so if you can measure the extent to which monozygotic twins are more alike than dizygotic twins, you can say that there's a genetic component, and there is in the case of homosexuality. So we do have a problem, because as you rightly say, any genetic tendency to prefer to mate with your own sex is not likely to get passed on with the same frequency as a genetic tendency to prefer to mate with the opposite sex. So there is a problem there. It seems to be about 10% of the male population, and that's definitely too many to just be written off. It's got to have some sort of explanation. Various explanations have been offered. The one I favor is that we may not be asking the right question when we talk about genes for homosexuality. It is true that now there are genes that tend to make you behave in a homosexual way. But those genes might not always have done that. In a different environmental condition, those genes might have done something quite different. So it could be that homosexual behavior is a joint product of a gene and an environmental feature. And I don't know what that environmental feature might be. So suppose the environmental feature that we're talking about was bottle feeding of babies. I just made that up. I mean, there's no evidence for that. It's the kind of thing I'm talking about. So suppose that there's a gene which interacts with the environment such that if you're bottle-fed as a baby and you have that gene, then you have a tendency to be homosexual. Now, in our wild ancestors, when the natural selection was going on, nobody was bottle-fed. And so that gene never had a chance to express that particular effect. Now, I made it up about bottle feeding, mm-hmm. but there could be something else about our modern environment which interacts with the possession of a certain gene to give homosexual tendencies.
A conversation I had with evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins from 2009. Dawkins will be appearing in Des Moines this Saturday afternoon at Hoyt Sherman Place. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's get back to that conversation. And when I spoke with Richard Dawkins in 2009, it was a few months after former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee had won the Iowa caucuses. And during that campaign, Huckabee was repeatedly asked about evolution, and he responded with these words, "I believe there is a God who is active in the creation process. Now, how did he do it? And when did he do it? And how long did it take? I don't honestly know, and I don't think knowing that would make me a better or worse president. If anybody wants to believe that they are the descendants of a primate, they are certainly welcome to do it." The words of Mike Huckabee. So I asked Richard Dawkins whether Huckabee's position on evolution was relevant or important.
Well, I mean, on the face of it, you might think it doesn't matter because, after all, you don't actually need to be well-versed in biology in order to run a country, you might think. I remember that when, I don't know whether you remember, when Sherlock Holmes first met Dr. Watson, and it turned out that Holmes knew nothing whatever about the planets, nothing about the solar system. And Watson was completely shocked. And Holmes said, "But I don't need to know about the solar system in order to be a detective." Well, I think that's just silly. I mean, I think Watson in this case was right. You never know what you may need to know. And somehow, somebody who is so willfully blind to the facts about the world in which he lives is not somebody who can be trusted to be a good leader, a good president. You want somebody who is open-minded and who, although he may not know everything, of course nobody can know everything, nevertheless is not willfully ignorant and deliberately almost proud of being ignorant.
Mm. On this very broadcast, Governor Huckabee at that time advocated for intelligent design to be taught in public schools alongside evolution as an alternative theory. So why not let it be taught in schools as an alternative and let the most convincing theory win?
Yes, I mean, that's a superficially plausible argument because nobody likes to suppress a theory. I mean, if there are two different theories, then obviously we want to teach both of them. The problem is that in this case, there are not two different theories. They're not two different scientific theories. One of them is a scientific theory and the other one isn't. So it's a kind of false appeal to the fair-mindedness that most of us have, and certainly most of the American people have. It's a kind of trick of language where you say, well, let's teach both theories, and that automatically assumes that there really are two theories. I mean, there could be hundreds of theories. You could mm-hmm. teach the theory that, you know, the world is standing on the back of a turtle or something. Wait, there's got to be something going for it mm-hmm. in science in order for it to qualify for science class. But I think it's quite right to teach intelligent design in classes on religion.
You are a well-known atheist. How can, though, a belief in evolution go hand in hand with a belief in God be compatible?
I think it's difficult, but you'd have to ask somebody like Francis Collins or Kenneth Miller, who are devout Christians and also extremely sound on evolution. They seem to manage it fine, and so do most bishops that you're likely to meet or archbishops, etc. So there are plenty of people who do manage to marry the two up, and they do it by saying something like evolution is God's way of doing things.
Mm-hmm. So you personally cannot marry them, so to speak.
I think it's very difficult to. Yes, I find that an understanding how the fabulous illusion of design comes about by a perfectly explicable process of gradual evolutionary change, that that really does deeply undermine any tendency I might have to be religious.
What do you think are the motivations for those who challenge evolution in those ways, for those who you call in your book woefully misinformed?
Well, I think it really is religion. I don't want to say that all religious people do that, because, as I've just said, they don't. People like Francis Collins and bishops and Kenneth Miller don't. Nevertheless, those people who do, what was the phrase, willfully obstruct or something like that?
Your words, woefully misinformed.
Misinformed. I mean, the motivation for that does come from religion. A bishop would say it's misguided religion, but it certainly comes from religion.
Do you assign any blame for the misunderstanding of evolution to the scientific community?
Well, I think we are to blame insofar as we don't spend enough time and effort in trying to explain it, which is why I've written however many books it is on the subject. I do think that scientists have a responsibility to do more than just go into the lab and do their research and publish papers.
Can we look back and say that Darwin got anything wrong, any aspect of his writing that you can look to and say, we could do better there?
Yes, he got wrong just about everything to do with genetics. He had the genetics of his time, which was very wrong. There's a sort of irony in that the solution was actually staring them in the face in the form of the work of Gregor Mendel in what's now the Czech Republic. But neither Darwin nor just about anybody else knew about it, and it wasn't rediscovered until the turn of the century, until about 1900. So Darwin got his genetics completely wrong, and everything in The Origin of Species which refers to the details of heredity is wrong. Fortunately, it doesn't matter, because for Darwin's purposes, all that mattered was that there should be heredity. All that mattered was that in some sense, like should beget like. But in terms of the details, if genetics was as Darwin thought it was, and as everybody in the 19th century except Mendel thought it was, then evolution couldn't work.
Given what we've learned about evolution since that publication, since Darwin's death, what would he be most surprised about, do you think?
I would have thought he would be most surprised about DNA and the fact, the wonderful fact, he would be overjoyed with about it, the fact that every cell of every creature contains a complete textual account of how it was built, of how to make one like that. And that is a most marvelous thing. Darwin knew that in some way children resembled their parents. But if Darwin were to be shown that every creature contains in its cells a great book, I mean, it's nowadays we call it digital. Darwin wouldn't have known the meaning of the word digital, but he'd have understood that it was like a book with letters of the alphabet, with characters, with sentences, with paragraphs, with punctuation marks, something that gets copied accurately, literally copied accurately.
Every cell.
Every cell, yes. Mm. I mean, with occasional inaccuracies, but most copying is accurate. Mm. And because it's digital, you can actually count the accuracy, count the inaccuracy. You can actually count the number of resemblances and differences between every species and every other species. So when you want to compare animals in order to work out how they evolved and imagine what their ancestors might have looked like, in Darwin's time, you did it with anatomy, you did it with bones and things like that. Now we do it with digital text. Mm. We can actually count the number of differences, the number of similarities between each species and each other species with respect to each of their genes. And that's a marvelous thing to be able to do.
You said this would be a great surprise to Darwin, a fabulous surprise.
He would have been joyed
about this. What would we say, let's go 150 years into the future, What would be the greatest mystery of evolution that would give you the greatest joy?
Yes, I think the mystery of human consciousness. If you think about the computer that you no doubt use, it does very clever things and it can play chess and that sort of thing. But what it doesn't do is have subjective feelings. It doesn't have a consciousness of what it's like to perceive the color blue, what it's like to love, what it's like to hate, what it's like to be amused, what it's like to feel warm or cold, what it's like to be unhappy. These are deeply mysterious properties of living things, at least of humans, because we know we ourselves experience them, and we presume that some other creatures at least can as well. Somehow they must have evolved in nervous systems, in brains, and it would be wonderful to understand how.
A conversation I had with evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins from November of 2009. Dawkins is scheduled to speak in Des Moines at Hoyt Sherman Place this Saturday afternoon. It's a ticketed event being put on by Secularity USA, a group that says its primary goal is raising public awareness of the dangers of religious bias in government and promoting the traditional separation of church and state. That does it for our program today. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. Thank you.